Hey folks, make sure to stick around for the outro after today's interview.
Hey y'all, I'm Whitney Scarborough, the host of Wits End. Here we are real people asking hard questions. If you think you hear the hum of a fridge or a train in the background, it's because you probably are. We are recording these episodes from the comfort of my home in a small town called LaGrange, Texas.
Today I sit with Hannah Scott, who joins us from the Dallas area to talk about ethical adoption and her work at the Archibald Project. Leaving a toxic church situation and red flags looking back, and both of us being raised by parents in ministry and growing up in the church. Let's dive in. Okay, Hannah, this is super fun. I am so excited you're here on the podcast today.
I am so glad to be here. This is so fun to get to chat with you.
I know. Okay. So we were just talking about travel. This wasn't even something planned, but we were just cracking up about traveling with spouses and podcasts.
Yes.
And I was telling you about how Tim and I went on our 15th year anniversary trip, and we were going to Ireland, but our flights got canceled. So we ended up having to drive to New York City to get to our flights. And I was telling you how day one was like romantic,
road trip,
music, listening to podcasts all day, windows down type of feel. And then day two is like, this, I'm going to actually kill you. Like, this is actually fun.
Yeah. That is every road trip for me and my husband, Kyle. Like the existential dread that fills me when I know we have a road trip coming up is like oppressive. I do not enjoy road trips. I don't think they're fun. Even before we had kids, his family lives in Alabama. And so, you know, if you drive straight through, it's like 10, 11 hours. It is not close. And even before we had kids, I hated it. And now that we have kids, I'm like, it is the absolute worst thing in the world to me. And so we have now worked out a system where Kyle drives with our two big kids and I fly with the baby because she doesn't like the car and I don't like the car, and everyone's happier that way. And he does fun things on them with road trips that I would never do. Like, they always stop at Chili's and get a molten lava cake for dinner, which I'm like, why would anyone voluntarily eat at Chili's? Not my vibe. Like, there's so much better food out there. No hate to you Chili's fans.
I'm gathering that maybe Kyle is more of the like enjoy the journey and you're more of like, let's.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm like, we need to stop as few times as possible. And when I do have to just suck it up and go with him, we get Chick-fil-A for breakfast, Chick-fil-A for lunch, Chick-fil-A for dinner, like just anywhere we can stop and let the kids run wild. Yes. And then I'm like, we're not stopping again. We bring a little IKEA potty in the car with us. And if the kids have to pee, we pull over on the side of the road and they pee in the potty and we dump it out and keep going because I just want to get there and be done. And Kyle is like, let's stop at a park. Let's go to Chili's. They always stop halfway and stay at a hotel. And he picks one with an indoor pool so that when they get there, they can swim.
Oh,
absolutely not. Put me on a flight, take all my money and don't make me do that.
Oh, I love it. And I'm sure people who are listening are like, yes, I completely understand. And I'm sure there's a wide range of like just great stories out there that I would actually love for people to share. But that wasn't really on the plan.
I'm sure. I love road tripping and
yeah. I love that we just dove into that. So Hannah, welcome to Wits End today. I want you just to start
by thank you so much
telling us a little bit about you. I know we just got the gist that you have three kids and a husband who loves road trips, but just give us a little bit more about your life.
Yes. So Kyle and I have been married for coming up on 8 years now. We have three wonderful children. We have our oldest girl is in kindergarten. And then our middle child is a little boy and he is four. And then we have a 14-month-old baby. She's a toddler now, but she's a baby forever and always. She's my baby. And our first two kiddos are biological and our third is adopted. So our youngest, Imani, is, we adopted her through domestic infant adoption. So she was born here in Dallas last December. So she is 14 months now and just the light of our life. So she's great. And I work for an organization called the Archibald Project, and we use storytelling to inspire and mobilize people to get involved in adoption and foster care and family preservation. And we always, always, always come at it from an ethical point of view. So I do a lot of advocating. I am the social content manager. So I do everything on their Instagram. I do newsletters. I do a little bit of back end stuff on the website. And I love it. It's wonderful and it's fulfilling. And I do that part time. So I spend about 20 hours a week doing that, and the rest of the week just corralling my children.
I love it. Well, I love that you just dove into the topic of adoption, because I wanted us to go there together, but talk a little bit about your story with adoption and how God led you guys to that process.
Yes, totally. So we, adoption had always kind of been plan A for us. It was always something that we wanted. We weren't sure if biological kids were really ever in the cards for us. But we also got married super young. I was 21, Kyle was 23. And so we just said, you know, we've got all the time in the world. We'll wait 5 years and we'll figure it out later. And then 6 months later, I was pregnant with our first. And so we were like, okay, great. Biological children, here we go. So we had Ayla. And then when Ayla, right around her first birthday, you know, we kind of felt that prick in our hearts of, we want to grow our family. How are we going to do this? You know, do we want to do the biological route again? Do we want to pursue adoption? And we actually started doing some foster care classes to think about maybe going that route. And thankfully, we just had really wise people in our lives who said, hey, if adoption is your goal, then foster care is not for you. Because the goal of the foster care system is always going to be reunification. Where it is possible and safe, the goal is reunification. And if you can't root wholeheartedly for that, then you're doing a disservice to the kiddos in your care and to the families of the kiddos in your care and to yourself as well. And so we took that to heart and said, okay, we want more kids. And while adoption from foster care is completely possible and beautiful, obviously that is not the primary goal. So we shifted, we spent some time in prayer. We ended up having Jonah biologically as well. And then when Jonah was about 18 months old, kind of felt that prick of, okay, we're ready to grow our family. How are we going to do this? And ultimately decided on growing our family through adoption. So we were pretty naive about the adoption process when we started. We had walked through adoption with some friends and kind of seen what they had just experienced. And anyways, so we started looking at agencies and kind of, you know, figuring it all out, trying to see, okay, you know, do we want to pick a local agency? Do we want to pick a national agency? Do we want to, you know, there's a thousand different things you have to think through when you start the adoption process. And the organization that I work for now, the Archibald Project, I have only been working for them for a few months, but I've been a long time fan of theirs. And so they have tons of adoption content on their website. And so we really just kind of started pouring through everything that they had available and just realizing that there is a lot in the adoption world that is super corrupt and super unethical. And so a lot of what we consumed from their website and from their Instagram and from just all the content that they put out, it really shaped the way we went about adoption. And so there were agencies that were just automatic no's because it was really, really important to us to have an agency that was not going to just place children for adoption, no matter the cost. You know, we wanted an agency that was going to really care for birth mothers and really make sure that this was the best solution for all involved and the best choice for all parties of what's called the adoption triad, which is the birth parents, birth family, adoptive family, and the adoptee as well. So we found an agency and we moved forward with them, and we were active for about a year. And then our sweet Imani was born. So she has been, we got the call when she was 2 hours old. So we have had, I mean, she's been our child since then, you know. Mm-hmm. So we got the call when she was 2 hours old, and She spent about a week in the NICU. She was born a little bit early, not due to the fault of anyone. Her sweet birth mother just went into labor and progressed a little more quickly than they could handle stopping. And so she was born early, spent a little bit of time in the NICU, and then came home, and she's just the light of our lives.
I love it. So I love what you kind of dove into this a little bit earlier, talking about ethical adoption. And our conversations have been really enlightening for me, just to learn more about how things have shifted in some needed ways over the past few decades. So just talk a little bit more about that. And what do you mean by unethical adoptive practices, and kind of what are some of the things that have shifted in the right direction over the last couple of decades?
God's design is for families to be together, right? Adoption is not part of God's good and perfect plan, right? When he created Adam and Eve, and when he created the earth and started with humanity, adoption in a perfect world would not exist, right? So adoption exists as a byproduct of sin. Now, adoption can be good and beautiful and wonderful. Obviously, I love my daughter. I am so thankful that she's mine. But that adoption does always, it starts with brokenness, right? The separation of a child from its biological parent always creates a trauma. And so adoption can be beautiful, but you also have to recognize that adoption starts with trauma. And so the, you know, if you look at the shift in conversation surrounding adoption, you know, even watching shows like Friends. Okay. So we're talking the 90s, the early 2000s. Okay. Do you remember the episode where Chandler and Monica are like meeting with friends to talk about adopting? Have you even watched Friends, or am I just?
Yes. No. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So Chandler accidentally tells the child that he's adopted, right? So this is even like late 90s. It was still common practice to adopt a child and never tell them that they're adopted, right? And that is, it just creates issues in a lot of different ways. And so one of the things that we, Kyle and I, try really hard to do, and one of the things that the Archibald Project really advocates for, is listening to adoptees, listening to adult adoptees and former foster youth, because they're the experts on their own experience, right? So they can say, hey, I deserve to know my full story. It's not fair for you to not share with me part of who I am, right? So sorry, I'm kind of going in a, I'm not going in the most linear direction here. So
no, that's
forgive
okay.
me.
You're doing, this is great. You're good.
But yeah, so the conversation has shifted as a lot of adult adoptees have now grown up and use their voice to advocate for other adoptees. And so now we have all these adult adoptees who are advocating and we're just learning so much from them. And so part of what we're learning and have been learning for years is just that the adoption world has become really unethical, and there is just a lot of corruption. So the unfortunate thing with adoption is that it really is a business. You know, there are adoption agencies that is all they do. And so not that there's anything wrong with an adoption agency, but if you're an adoption agency and you have, you know, staff that you have to pay for, and you have health insurance that you're providing for those staff, you have to continually create income to provide for all those people, right? And so adoption turns into less of a, hey, let's find families for children that need them, and more of, hey, let's meet our quarterly revenue stream, or our you know, necessary bottom line income, because we have to pay all these staff. And then, so that's kind of it from a business point of view. But there's also like a definitely a greediness of there are people who it's just their job, and they don't necessarily care about adoption. They don't necessarily really want to advocate for these kids or these families. And it's just about meeting the bottom line and placing as many children as they can. So adoption has become a business, and there is a supply and demand issue. And so there just turns a lot of what looks like something really good has a really dirty underbelly to it. So for example, there are agencies. So the agency that we used, they said, hey, an expectant mother can come to us at any point in time in her pregnancy, and we will start taking care of her. So we can start paying for her medical bills. We can provide groceries. We can buy her maternity clothes if she needs them. You know, if she doesn't have a safe place to stay, we can help provide that. And at our agency, they said, hey, until you are at least 6 months pregnant, until you have felt the baby move, and until you've had at least one ultrasound, we're not going to talk about adoption, right? Because so much can change in a pregnancy between 8 weeks and, you know, 30 weeks. And so that was how our agency operated. And then they also said, hey, at any point in time, if you choose to parent, we will connect you with resources that can help you do that. We will pray for you. We will bless you. And you do not have to pay us back a penny of what we've spent on you. Well, there are other agencies who will flip that around and say, yes, we'll pay for groceries. We'll pay for rent. We'll do all this. And then when someone is, you know, 32, 36 weeks pregnant and maybe having second thoughts about placing their child for adoption, they'll say, hey, that's great. You're welcome to parent, but you do have to pay us back anything we've spent on you. And we've spent $12,000 so far. And so then it puts a woman who is already probably dealing with a lack of support and a lack of resources. If she's considering placing her child for adoption, it's likely that she's already dealing with that. Now in a position to essentially have to buy back her child, right? And so then it's essentially used as a coercion tactic to convince these women who are having second thoughts to move forward with placing their child for adoption, which obviously is just disgusting, right? It's gross and it's horrible and it's unethical and it's corrupt. And so we do a lot of advocating for, hey, if you are considering adoption and you are looking at adoption agencies, you need to make sure that the agency that you're using is not going to use these coercive tactics, however subtle or aggressive they may be. Because for one, if you are coming at this from a Christian point of view of, hey, God has called us to care for the orphan and the widow, and you know we want to provide a safe and loving home for a child that needs it, then you're going to have to answer before God for the way you go about that, right? It's not about just, I'm going to get a child however I'm going to get a child, or I'm going to do whatever it takes because I want to grow my family. You're going to have to answer to God for the way that you do this. And you're also going to have to answer to your child. Like there are so many things that I carry the weight of with my daughter's adoption that I have spent many hours in tears over the fact that she is not with her biological family. You know, I love her and I am so thankful that she's mine, but I'm also devastated for her for that loss. But I know with confidence that at least I can look at her for her entire life and say, hey, when we adopted you and for your entire life, we have always gone about it in an above board and ethical way. We didn't try to convince your birth mother to place you with us. We didn't use any coercive tactics. She chose us and we said yes, and we are thankful and we are sad at the same time. And so I can look at my daughter and recognize the brokenness of adoption and also recognize that I don't have to hide anything from her in it, because we were really, really strategic about the agencies that we used.
So talk a little bit about, you know, this shift, because I remember this in my growing up years, having family friends who their kids were adopted, and it was kind of this hush conversation of, do the kids know that they're adopted?
Totally.
And where we now know that they're adopted, do they know they're adopted? And almost, when are you telling them they're adopted? So kind of what you were talking about earlier. And I just want to know now, even in this shift, which makes total sense what you're saying about the child deserving to know their full story. But for you guys in your family, how does this work out as far as this open conversation and even this open relationship, where mm-hmm. you said that you believe it's ideal for Amani to have a relationship with her birth mother? And how do you do that? Because I think that's a messy, you know, I think probably
it is,
right? It's not as cut and dry, and yet you still believe that that is the better yes. option.
Yes, totally. So a lot of the shifting conversation has just been from listening to adult adoptees and recognizing, hey, the things that we, you know, in the adoption world maybe did 30 or 40 years ago, that we were doing from a place of trying to be well-intentioned, were not good for the child ultimately. And so much of the shift has come from now adult adoptees growing up and using their voice to advocate for others and saying, hey, I know that maybe you did that because you thought it was best, but it wasn't. Like, here is all the all the ways that I have had to reckon with not fully knowing my story, or, you know, finding out that I was adopted as an adult, or whatever the case is. And so much of it just comes from learning from adult adoptees and listening to their voices first and foremost. And, you know, kind of often in the adoption world, the adoptive parents are glorified, and we hear their stories more often than not. And they're, you know, often painted as kind of the saviors who swooped in, and it's just not a truthful and not a narrative that's honoring to the adoptee or to their first families. And so much of the shift in conversation has just come from adult adoptees advocating for change. And so, you know, we really try to push listening to adult adoptees, not just for adoptive parents or for people considering adoption, but for anyone, right? Because you're going to come into contact with adopted people in your life. And then as far as just the open conversations, so again, so much of that has come from learning from adult adoptees, but also just from research of saying, hey, we have done years of study and years of research, and we see that these three groups thrive where there is openness. And obviously, you know, for some adoptees and for some adopted families, that's not always possible. You know, there could be safety concerns, there could be other issues, but where it is safe and healthy, to keep those biological ties intact where you can. And so for some families, that looks like just completely open relationships, you know, that you come over for lunch every Sunday and you come and have slumber parties, or, you know, really keeping that communication as open as possible. Well, for some families, that's just not plausible. There is a woman that I have connected with just through the Archibald Project that both of her children are adopted. And her son's biological brother lives an hour and a half from them. And so twice a year, they have him over for a slumber party for two or three nights, and they get to have their brother weekends because that's what both families can manage to honor those biological ties. And really, you know, adult adoptees would say, hey, having any sort of biological tie is important, even if it's not with a birth parent. You know, if we can connect our child with her aunt or her uncle or her grandma and grandpa, you know, anyone who has that biological relationship with them is beneficial. And so, so in our home, we do have an open adoption, and we talk often about, Imani's birth mom. You know, we call her by her name and we pray for her by name, and we have a picture of her up in Imani's room. And we talk about how Imani looks like hers and her curls look just like her birth mom's. And, you know, obviously my beautiful daughter is Black and I am white. And so there's no question, you know, she would have known she was adopted either way, but we also have talked about it from day one. We talked about the adoption process with our older two before we started it. And we talked about, what that would look like and why we were doing it. And so there's no secrecy in our family, and there's no hiding from adoption in our family, because ultimately, it is part of Imani's story, and she deserves to know it. And there are age appropriate ways that we will go about bits and pieces of it, but she has every right to know the full extent of her story when it's age appropriate. And so, we kind of keep that line of communication open, and we talk about it often. And you know, at first, when we first brought her home from the hospital, it felt kind of awkward to look at this child and say, you look just like your birth mom. But, you know, the more you talk about it, the more natural the conversation becomes. And even, you know, Ayla last week said, I wonder if Imani misses her birth mommy. And I said, you know, baby, I am sure that she does. I'm sure that she misses her, and I'm sure her birth mama misses her too. And we talk about, hey, adoption has two sides to it. We're really thankful that Imani is in our family, and we're really sad that she had that loss of her first family too. And we can feel both of those things at the same time. So we try to keep the conversation in our family as open as possible.
We'll be back in just a moment after a word from our sponsor. Well, now is the part of the show where I just get to give a fun shout out to all of those sponsors who have partnered with Woven over the course of this year. So, Literal Insurance, you know who you are on the LaGrange Square. We love you guys. Rhinestone Angel, one of the cutest boutiques in all of Texas. which is coming to you out of Flatonia. Y'all are the best. First Presbyterian Church here in LaGrange. We love that you guys have just partnered with us. And Thrivent Financial on LaGrange Square. Not only have you guys partnered with us, but you've allowed us to use your office spaces for our purposes. Camp Tejas Retreat Center in Giddings. Thank you, guys. Nietzsche Insurance. What a gift you guys have been to us. And then finally, my personal favorite, Scar and Sons. You know who you are. So all of these amazing sponsors, we love you guys. Thank you for making not only the ongoing work of the local ministry possible, but also the ongoing work of the podcast, the writing, and all of the behind-the-scenes things that are going on to continue to grow the kingdom work happening through Woven Ministry. We're grateful. And now back to the show.
So Hannah, you shared about how you recently dealt with a toxic church situation that created some distrust that you had to work through. But I'd love for you just to tell us a little bit about that and what that process has been like as God has brought healing for your family.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. So my husband and I we live in Dallas now. We lived in Fort Worth for 5 years and we went to the same church in Fort Worth for all 5 years. And we really genuinely loved it. We had a good, solid community group. And we had people, you know, we felt known and we felt loved and we felt like, truly, we just felt really thankful for it. We saw other friends and other believers struggling with, churches that were toxic or didn't have their best interests at heart or, you know, weren't actively discipling their people. And we were like, oh man, you know, that's not our story. We're so thankful for our church and for the way they do things. And we just had a big shift take place. And so, actually in our small group, we had child abuse that we just were unaware of some dear friends of ours. And the way that it was handled by the church was just really, truthfully concerning. We did everything we could and we tried to advocate and we went to the elders and we went to the pastors and, we tried to do all of the right things. And just kind of kept getting shut down left and right. And so for us, the big question became, you know, how long do you stay in a church and try to change the culture? Because this is the bride of Christ and this is where we have been, you know, part of the body of believers for the last 3, 4, 5 years. And at what point do you say, hey, we got to draw the line and leave? And so that was just really hard for us to kind of reckon with and kind of work through. And we really struggled with that tension of, do we want to stay? Do we feel called to stay and to keep fighting and to keep advocating and to try to enable change in a place that clearly needs it? Or do we need to wipe the dust from our feet and move on because this place is not a safe place for us to be? And ultimately that was where we landed. And it was so hard because again, it was a church that we had loved and that we had grown in, and that we had built relationships with wonderful people. And we ended up having to step away, which was so hard. And it did create just so much distrust for us of, specifically of church leadership. And so, you know, Kyle and I have both done a lot of soul searching since then. We've both been in counseling and both tried to root through the issues that we left that church with. And I think we both handled it differently and both were affected by it differently. But for me, I walked away saying, church leadership is not good and healthy. And they are only there for power and to protect themselves. And I can't trust them. And so it created this bitterness and this distrust in me towards the church and towards church leadership that I've really had to wrestle through. And the Lord has been just kind and gracious to me as I've wrestled through that. And you know, I'm thankful that we worship a God who is not afraid of our hard questions. And we actually ended up moving out of Fort Worth into Dallas, which was kind of a welcome reprieve from all the grief and all the trauma that we had lived through in that last year and a half in Fort Worth. And so we now attend a wonderful, wonderful church that we love. And it has taken, we've been members of that church for 2.5 years, and it has taken a long time for me to actively choose to trust our church leadership now. And again, the Lord has been sweet and kind and faithful. And, you know, the first time I showed up at a church event, I mean, we moved in the middle of COVID, and so the church was only meeting once a month. And so we showed up and went to that service, and they announced that women's Bible studies and men's Bible studies were opening. And we got home, and I said, you know, Kyle, I think we should just jump in. You know, we're not going to go visit other churches. We're not, you know, COVID has made this hard. And so I think let's just jump in and we'll just keep a really close eye on things. And if we feel like this is anything like our old church, then we will cut and run so fast. Yeah. And so I signed up for women's Bible study and went to, like not even an event. They were just passing out our Bible study books. And I met the woman who was going to be my Bible study leader. And she was like, oh my gosh, you're new to the neighborhood. I'm so glad you're here. My name's Katie. This is Becca. This is Haven. And just started introducing me to all these people who just, I mean, really loved us and welcomed us with open arms, invited us to dinner that night. And I was terrified. I was, you know, scared of really wholeheartedly committing to people in a church again because of what we've been through. And even on the way to dinner, I was like, we shouldn't go. Turn around. Let's go home. I don't want to do this. But Kyle graciously pushed me forward. And so we went and just, I mean, we've just been blown away by the kindness of the Lord to bring us out of a place that was toxic and into a place that has continually discipled us and loved us and shown generosity to us. And a church whose leadership that even when I feel anxious, we can go to them and say, we feel anxious. And they're like, great, let's talk through it. Let's process this. There's no pretension. There's no hierarchy of, hey, I'm the head pastor, so you can't come talk to me, or we're the elders, and so you need to go through X, Y, and Z channels before you come to us. There's just openness. And that has just been healing and beautiful and wonderful for us.
So talk a little bit about the things that you guys began to see in retrospect, you know, hindsight being 2020, which is ironic because you moved to 2020, right?
Right. Right.
But what were some things that as you look back that now you could say, okay, those are maybe some red flags that I would encourage people to pay attention to if they think they're in a church situation that might be quote unquote toxic. How would you define that? And how would you advise someone?
Totally. So I would say some of the biggest red flags looking back, so the abuse happened in April. And we contacted the church elders and just said, hey, we need help. We need you to step into this situation. Dad was arrested and confessed and spent a couple nights in jail, and CPS stepped in. And so from a legal standpoint, all of the right things were happening, but we were like, hey, we have never dealt with this, and none of the other couples in our group have ever dealt with this. And so we would love for an elder to come and just speak to us and meet with us and care for us, because we're all grieving. You know, we did not know that our friends were dealing with this. We have this guy who we have loved and we have walked with, and we feel like we don't know him, and he's been lying to us for 4 years, and, you know, all the different things we were feeling. And again, that was in April, and they said, great, we've got some openings in November. And we were just shocked. And so I would say, looking back, that's one of the biggest red flags, was just an elder board that was not willing to make the time and space to deal with what was going on in the church, or to even meet with us about our concerns of what was going on in our group and in the church. So that was one of the biggest red flags. The other was, and there's a handful of them, but we just didn't feel that we could approach the pastors of the church. It felt like there was a hierarchy in place of, hey, if you have a concern, you go to one of the elders. And if the elder deems that concern big enough, then he's going to go to the pastor. And if the pastor decides that this is a big enough concern, then he'll reach out to you. And so there were just all these kind of barriers of communication in place. And so it really did take us months to be able to sit down and meet with an elder and to express our concerns. And so those are two of the biggest red flags. One, the elders just would not make the time and space to sit down and meet with us. And two, we didn't feel that when the elders shut us down, that we could approach the pastor. You know, it was not a huge church and he didn't know our names, you know? Mm-hmm. And so for us to be in a church that was not massive and for the pastor to really have no idea who we were, despite the fact that we were home group leaders and active in the church and there every Sunday, was concerning. So we were being led by and having decisions made by someone who, did not know us. And really, I think we can look back and say, did not know the congregation at large.
But on the flip side of that, one of the things that I wanted us to touch on was both of us have parents who have been in ministry, served in nonprofit, served in Camping World, served in campus ministry churches. But it's interesting because I think that, you know, when we first met just within the last year, and connected, I feel like we had a lot of just similarities because of having had parents who have served in ministry. Mm-hmm. But somehow, miraculously, I think, and I'm so thankful that we both really have good relationships with our parents. And we both, in our own ways, are walking with Christ and, you know, are getting to express a lot of and live out a lot of what we have been raised in. And so I know that we know that there's no formula and our parents were not perfect, but I would love for us just to talk a little bit about some of the things that our parents did well and what we even learned from them.
Yeah. You know, I was, when you sent me the itinerary and I was thinking about, what kind of the different talking points for this would be, I just was so thankful for my parents, as I'm sure you are for yours, just looking back and seeing, you know, they did some things really well and some things really poorly. But one thing that just really stood out to me when I first started thinking about it was my dad was always quick to apologize. Like when he did something wrong, he came back and he owned it. And he said, you know, I did this and I shouldn't have, and I'm sorry. And sometimes those conversations were really uncomfortable and I did not want to be a part of them, but he just was really, really quick to apologize. And I so appreciate that. And it's something I try to do with my kids now, because there was never this idea of, hey, mom and dad are perfect and you guys need to live up to our standards. Like, we knew that mom and dad were sinners and that they struggled and that when they did, they were going to apologize for it and own up to it and try to do better next time. And I think that has massively helped now with our adult relationships with my parents, because that's still true today. You know, my dad is still quick to apologize. And another thing he did was he would take at least 5 minutes at the dinner table. Well, we ate dinner together every single night. I think that was really important too, because, you know, there's seven kids in my family and we were all over the place with school and sports and friends and, you know, dad working in ministry and mom was home with us, but dinner time was the one time that we were really all together in a room at the end of the day. And so I'm really thankful for that just kind of tradition and understanding that they started, that it was just expected that you were home for dinner because that's the only time in the day that we're going to all be together. Mm-hmm. And dad would always make sure and take like 5 to 10 minutes of dinner and just talk about something cool that God was doing in his ministry. And so we always knew where God was moving. And so it just kind of created in us an openness and a willingness to talk about what we saw God doing. And my dad also often cried during those conversations. Is Dan a crier?
Oh yes. My dad is.
Okay. Yes.
He's like,
that's what I thought.
Of the criers. Yes.
That's what I thought. And I think that was so good too, especially, you know, growing up in the 90s with kind of this toxic masculinity, to see my dad crying at the dinner table most nights. Yes. Over something cool that God was doing was just amazing.
I think it's so funny that you brought that up. Literally, we didn't even get to talk about all the things that, you know, we were going to share for this. And one of the first things I wrote down was that my parents consistently apologized. That stood out to me. And I love that it stood out to you too. I remember reading a book by Donald Miller called Scary Close a couple years ago. And he said, one of the things that he said in there was that one of his observations of families over the years and families that have a longstanding relationship with their children and into adulthood is that factor that they're able to readily apologize and own up to what they did wrong. And that has stood out to me because I have seen that in my own family so much that my parents were really good at that. And so then it taught us how to be good at that, not just in our, with our parents, but with our siblings and with our, now in my marriage, now with my kids, you know? And so, I mean, really it's like the heart of Christ, like his forgiveness that he brings, it's just being lived out in this very practical, real life way. So
I think our dads are very similar, and our dads are, you know, dear friends. So it doesn't surprise me that they're similar. But I think it's one of the reasons that I love your parents so much is because they remind me so much of mine.
I love that. Yes. Well, and I think I shared this with you, even I think, in one of our previous conversations, just that one of the things that I've seen and that I'm so thankful for is that now as an adult, I can look back and say with 100% confidence that my parents were the same on stage as they were behind closed doors. Yes, so any platform that they had, you know, any time that they were speaking in front of people, whether it was in a church setting or, you know, some other stage that they had been given, that I knew that what they were saying was actually being lived out in our home. And so, you know, when my dad was talking about spending time with the Lord, I would get up and see my dad at 5:30 in the morning on the couch, just praying and reading his Bible, you know, or when my mom was talking about, you know, about this topic of forgiveness, I knew my mom had asked me for forgiveness the day before, you know? And so, I think that that is one thing that I encourage parents now, because they might not have a ministry stage, regardless of whatever role, you know, any parent is in or any job that they have, there is still a quote unquote stage of their life, right? Where they are given some sort of a platform, and it might just be, even if it's a stay at home parent, right? We live one way as an adult, and then we turn around and do these things in parenting that I think we forget how important it is for them to be consistent. You know, when I say to my kids, it's really important that you don't speak ugly about people behind their back. And then they hear me on the phone talking negatively about somebody who's not present. Well, that is me living an incongruent life. Right.
Right.
So that's a minor example, but I think it speaks volumes. And so again, I don't think that my parents were perfect in that, and were there times where, you know, I would see them say something on stage and kind of smirk as a teenager because I thought, you know, I was annoyed or, you know,
yes, totally.
Of course, you know, but now looking back, and it's still true even today, you know. So
Well, and I think too, you know, we saw in my parents, certainly the consistency between their kind of onstage presence, because both of our dads were, you know, kind of prominent ministry leaders, whether it was pastoring or dad working at camp, but they were the same on stage that they were at home. And they were also the same in their friendships that they were at home. And so like when we, you know, we were homeschooled for a season, we were in school for a season, but we had just a really consistent friend group that, you know, my mom had her dearest friends that are still some of her dearest friends today. And, you know, we would have play dates and we would go and do homeschool together or whatever. And my mom was the same there with her best friends who loved her and knew her more than anyone else in the world that she was in our home. And so to be able to look at them and say, okay, you're the same person on stage and you're the same person in our neighbor's house and you're the same person in our own home, I think is amazing. Because I think that I even sometimes struggle with my own children of like when we are out on play dates, feeling like I need to be a more put together mother than I am, or I need to, you know, put on some sort of pretension to make me look or feel better about myself than I am, or something like that, you know? And so to see that my parents did that so well is convicting for me to say, hey, I don't want my kids to ever feel like I'm one person with one group of friends and a completely different person at church and a completely different person at home, you know?
Yeah.
And so just seeing that consistency in them between the stage and their friendships and their home life was massive for me.
Yeah. That's so cool. Any other thoughts that you have that along this line that you wanted to share?
Yeah. Two more thoughts. So, one is, my parents have changed a lot since I was a child, as I'm sure yours have.
Yeah.
And they have welcomed us into conversations as they've changed. And so, you know, things that maybe they've changed their mind on theologically, you know, obviously not the big points of the gospel, those have stayed the same, but maybe some other like secondary, tertiary issues that they have, you know, had one point of view as a child and now have a different point of view now that they're older and I'm an adult. They've always welcomed us into those conversations. There's never been a topic that's like off limits of, you know, we don't talk about this, or there's never been a confusion of like, hey, you used to believe this and now you believe this, because the lines of communication have stayed open. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that we've done a lot of family therapy. Really? And so, so we've done like family therapy sessions with a mediator and with, you know, my parents and all seven kids and spouses, tagging along, and that's just been helpful. I mean, truly there have been things that we have walked through as a family in my adult life that have been really hard that we have not always known the best way to handle. And so mom and dad have said, hey, we're going to step out and we are going to pay for a counselor to come in and work through this with us because we want to do this well. And so I think that's been huge too, of just being able to see that they don't believe that they are 100% right and the only voice of truth and the only voice of reason, but being willing to say, hey, we're going to bring someone else into this situation and help us as a family process it and work through it, because it matters to us that we all get to have a voice and that we have someone else here speaking truth into us as well.
Hannah, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. And
thank you for having me, Whitney. It's a joy.
Oh my gosh, I'm so thankful. It's been so fun. And I only just wish that we lived closer so we could just have these conversations more often.
And now stay tuned for the outro.
Hey gang, welcome to another outro where we are picking Whitney's brain about organizational leadership. The question of the day is, why does the world need this particular ministry?
That's a really good question. Well, for starters, Woven didn't come around because it was like this noble effort of, you know what? I just need to start this. And there's this big dream of, wow, this is what's needed. And I'm going to start this. It was never like that, and it never has been like that. It's always been something that has really happened organically, and it's been this gradual process of the Lord presenting some needs and me stepping into my gifts more fully and those intersecting. And so I have just seen how God has used my gifts and my willingness and my just kind of stepping one foot in front of the other, and then continue to reveal the needs and the spaces that he's calling me to step into with those gifts. And so that's been the way that it's happened. But now that we're here, and now that Woven is a nonprofit and it exists, and it's a 501c3 registered entity, I think that the best answer to your question is that it goes back to our mission statement, which is to equip women to study the Bible and to cultivate meaningful relationships. And regardless of if Woven exists or not, those things will always be so, so important. You know, it will always be important for us to come around the Word of God and to more deeply know the character of God through his word and study the person of Christ through his word. And it will always be really important for us to have meaningful, deep, rich, abundant relationships. And so those two things are not significant because there's a ministry to back them up, but they are significant in their own right. And they're worth spending time on, regardless of if woven exists. And so what I see is that when women come around the Word of God together to study and to know the person of Christ and to understand God's heart for redemption as it's revealed in the scriptures. And then when women do that together in community, then it's like the best of both worlds. And it's a bringing together of these two things where deeper relationships form as a result. And like those two are not two separate pieces. Really, they work together to kind of form the unified vision. And so that's my elevator pitch. But that elevator pitch would probably only work if the elevator like got stopped. You know what I mean? Like
you got stuck on the elevator with somebody.
Yeah, because otherwise it would probably be too long. I would have lost someone like 17 floors ago. I'm still talking to myself.
So how do you think that will transform over time?
I think that the methods and the ways that we carry out the mission statement will likely change and develop, but that the heart and the heartbeat of the ministry and that mission statement will stay consistent. I think we saw this even just in COVID. We had really just kind of gotten going in 2019. And then when the pandemic came, then, you know, we started to realize like, oh, wow, there's a lot of things that are going to have to shift as far as our model of reaching women and the ways that we're connecting. And it's going to look virtual versus in person for a while and those kinds of things. But the heartbeat of the ministry was still the same. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I guess the question is more based on the need for a ministry like Woven to exist. Do you think that need will change over time and transform?
Unless somehow people just start naturally getting good at craving to know God through His Word and selflessly pursuing Him and also just doing community naturally and foregoing the comfort of an individualistic, self-centered life that we're used to, then I don't think that need will go away.
So never?
No, never. I don't think that we're like in our flesh that we will ever naturally just drift towards those things, really. I think that it would be like saying, you know, I think that the need for gyms and exercise and, you know, health conscious entities is just going to go away because we're just going to all kind of get it and start being really healthy, exercised people that take good care of ourselves. I mean, I think everybody would just know like that's just not going to happen. We're not going to drift towards those things, you know? And so I think that the course of history, even just like taking a step back and looking over the scriptures as a whole would show that because of sin and because of its effect, not only on us as individuals, but also on the world as a whole and on communities, that our hearts are hopelessly bent away from God and that in our natural inclination is never going to just be to be so good that we fix ourselves or so hungry for relationships that we just naturally drift together. So what I'm saying is that I think that the need for Woven and ministries like Woven to be lighthouses in the communities that they're in will not go away. And if anything, they'll probably just continue to be more necessary and you know, lighthouses of places of hope in community where people are craving something different, you know?
Yeah.
So
it's because of our humanity that really any ministry is needed.
Yes. And I mean, I think we also know from like the big picture scope of the Bible, we know that eventually the God will send Christ, like that there will be a second coming of Christ and that there will be a rebuilding of the world. God will come to live among us, but that those things are not going to come about because of our efforts of getting it right. I mean, that really was kind of like the mentality that the Pharisees even had before Jesus came. The mentality was, if the nation of Israel can actually wholeheartedly, in a unified way, follow God's law, then the Savior will come back. The Messiah will come to us. And so, in a sense, their whole heart attitude and their understanding was that Jesus, the Messiah coming to them, was going to be on the basis of their obedience to the law. But that was never it. It was always been about God's abundant grace and Him initiating something that was not deserved. And so it's the same now, that we are not going to bring about Jesus coming back because we've gotten really good and our need for Him has lessened and He's just going to come be our buddy because, you know, we kind of figured it out without Him. It's not going to happen like that, you know? Jesus will come back because we have a gracious God who loves us and will continue to pursue us and show us His character and be faithful to the promises that He's made to us, regardless of whether or not we're faithful, you know? And so a ministry like Woven is way more about placing our hope in the right place, putting our hope in Christ versus getting it all right. You know, it's more about us setting our sights on Jesus, our rock and our Redeemer and our only true hope, our only unshakable joy and foundation. And He will return in His abundant grace, not because we've gotten it right or kind of gotten our act together.
Well, I'll look forward to that.
Jesus coming back or?
Yeah, that part.
That part. Me too.
All right. Love you.
Love you.
To find show notes for this and past episodes, or to engage on a deeper level, you can go to wovenministry.com/podcast. If you enjoy what you hear so far, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps listeners find and share this feed. If you'd like to tell us what you enjoyed about this podcast or ask your hard question, you can call us at 512-815-2446. That's 512-815-2446. You'll simply leave a voicemail with what's on your mind, and we might just include your voice on a future episode. Music and editing for the show is by Callan Brown, recording and production by Tim Scarborough. I'm Whitney Scarborough, and we'll be back here with more very soon. Thanks for listening.